On one of my first observations back in 1974, I was just before that I got a letter from an undergraduate at Santa Cruz named Steve Edberg, who wanted to go to an eclipse, and he was able to come along with my wife and me to that eclipse, which was also our honeymoon. So there were a few people. So Steve and I go way back in a very fun way. He's had a distinguished career at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory doing a wide variety of things, including what many of you have run into him when he was coordinating all the amateurs for Halley's Comet. So he's been aligned with some of the major astronomical events of the last few decades, and I'm very glad to be able to call on Steve Edberg now.
Thank you, Jane. And actually, I'd also like to say thanks to Ed Krupp and Griffith Observatory for hosting us, and to Patrick for inviting me to give a talk here. When I first heard that this was going to be here at Griffith, I was going to put this immediately on my calendar, and then even without having gotten around to that, Patrick contacted me and asked if I would like to make a presentation. So I appreciate this opportunity very much. I want to go back to something we actually heard about yesterday, partially at least, with Daniel's discussion of observing the beads, Halley's beads, and the whole transition into the chromosphere. Well, I want to expand that discussion and really have us think about what else we can be observing when we go to an eclipse. And it may be that it's because, and I don't really believe this, that Daniel got bored, that he decided he was going to start observing bead phenomena, but it could also...
I observed his as well, by the way.
Okay. But it could happen that, in fact, as Jay will surely remember, occasionally you can't even access the central line of an eclipse. And so you may want to take advantage of other phenomena. You may simply wish to be looking for other phenomena. So I'd like to go over all those with you as we explore an eclipse today. I'll be using examples from many of them. And just remind you that Bailey himself said that I was electrified at the sight of one of the most brilliant and splendid phenomena that can be imagined. And we've seen many pictures this past couple of days that certainly evoke that and evoke our own memories of such things. I don't really need to remind this group that, of course, the outer atmospheric layers of the sun include the chromosphere, the photosphere, and the corona, with prominences hanging in the corona. And of course, the corona extends much more than that single picture that I showed you there. If we're going to explore this, I do want to remind ourselves of what we want to see, and I found the Eclipse Salon just to do that. Oddly enough, I came across this picture is very fresh. It's only about a week old because I blundered onto this in the city of Arcadia, a few miles from my own home. So again, this group doesn't need to be reminded, but depending on the position of the moon, we see a total eclipse, we see an annular eclipse. Some of the phenomena that we see are shared between them, some of them are quite different. And that is because of the difference in the position of the shadow vertex at the time of the eclipse occurring. Position is everything. And incidentally, I would vote certainly for calling this a transit, since I don't remember, was one of our speakers earlier yesterday asked about that. So you need to be in the right place to see such a transit or an eclipse. In this case, I know some of us did manage to see a partial eclipse last March. If you happen to be flying on Hinode, you actually got to see briefly a total eclipse. It was in just the right place to catch a total eclipse of the sun, in this case in X-rays. So what phenomena can we observe? Well, of course, this is more or less a complete list when I'm preparing to discuss this with a group of many of whom will be eclipse virgins. And we can observe the partial phases. We observe Bailey's beads, the diamond ring, the chromosphere, prominences, corona, stars in the sky, maybe planets, the shadow and approach and recession, the whole landscape and sunset colors, shadow bands, weather phenomena, and people and animal phenomena. I'm going to leave the last one off because it doesn't almost matter with respect to where you are in the eclipse path when you're discussing it. The others all have some variation depending on that, and so I want to go over those with you. This is, again, just a simple example of a recent eclipse path. We've all done it. I'll thank Fred again, myself, for providing these maps to us. It's very convenient. And remind you that where to observe depends on these items. Position of the maximum totality, you think about, okay, where are we going to see the longest eclipse? And your first reaction is, of course, that's where I want to be. But after that, you need to think, well, can you get there? In 1974, we couldn't get to the center line of the path. The weather along the path can make a difference, and certainly areas that are going to be in the middle of the monsoon are probably not going to be choice, no matter how long totality is going to be there, unless you're really interested in seeing the effects of the shadow. You may choose based on the world situation and your personal politics. Some places you just simply may not want to go, or for whatever, a variety of reasons might be. You may also be concerned with the infrastructure there. Are you ready to go tenting, as Joel Harris showed us near Nouakchott in Mauritania? Or do you prefer something a little more refined, civilized, like a cruise ship? You also want to think, and my subject here today is the details of the eclipse phenomena that you are interested in or you may want to see. Other astronomical interests may occur. Maybe you want to observe something like the Glory and the Brocken Spectre that we saw just in the previous talk from the top of the mountain there. Or you want to visit observatories. Maybe there's a country you would like to visit or a geographical area that you'd like to visit. So these are the factors that go into it. I'm going to focus on the details of the eclipse phenomena. Again, I'm going to bring up a map from last year and just note to you that your choice may have depended on whether you wanted to be in excess of 4 minutes in all of the area to the left or southwest of this point, or if you were willing, not, for example, willing to go to Libya and you wanted to stay in Egypt, you may have missed out on a few seconds of totality. An easy decision to make, depending on your interests. But there is also the other direction that you want to be thinking about. And of course, again, the natural thing to do as one who wants to observe an eclipse is get on that center line. But I offer to you that that's not always the case. And let me just remind you that from above, the shadow does look like this. It's moving. I've got another picture here in a minute. We have these, again, wonderful pictures, that animations that have been made to show us the path. And just to show you that they weren't missing out on very much, even back in 1871, if you look here, you can actually see much of what is happening here. You see the eclipse starting at sunrise here, just on the, it looks like India. The Earth is rotating as the shadow moves over. You can see Australia here actually rotating around, and Australia doesn't have quite the right shape. The maps weren't quite right. But really, this illustrates everything you're seeing here, just in five steps instead of in multiples of them. And, in fact, we now have real live pictures, though we don't usually get them ahead of the eclipse. But it's really pretty marvelous technology to allow us to see what these look like. And I'll just remark for you that if you watch over here, you'll see the elongation of the shadow gets pretty narrow in the maximum zone, and then it gets elongated or circular in the maximum zone and then stretches out. We don't see it at the end because it's gone over the horizon from the satellite view. So what happens if you decide, perchance, to be off the center line? And I borrowed this, I made the calculations myself, just based on assuming a duration of 5 minutes, a width of 200 kilometers. You can play with the numbers as much as you'd like in any other way, but I thought they were helpful in trying to show what happens if you move off the center line, and that center line is from the center line, the duration follows this curve. Tom Van Flandern actually published this, illustration here, and was arguing that a lot of the edge effects are best at about 95% off the center line. Well, what happens at that place? Well, a duration that started out at 300 seconds goes down to about a minute and a half. Now that's so 5 minutes down to a minute and a half is a full two-thirds off. But what do you gain for that? And I'm not going to argue for or against 90 versus 97 versus that. What I want to show you is again, the phenomena that you do pick up and the durations that you can improve on by moving off center. So what can we look at? Again, this is the same list that I mentioned earlier, and let's pursue that a little bit. What happens when the dragon eats the sun? Well, we get to watch the partial phases, and really, not a lot of people go to see the partial phases. It's nice to hear, Jay, that you are making a trip in a couple weeks to see that, and I myself have made a trip not to that kind of distance, but I've caught the path of the partial phase with only about a mile or two. That's 2 to 3 kilometers inside the path in San Diego just about a year and a half ago. So we do that sort of thing just sometimes just for the fun of it, in my case anyway. But we can watch the partial phases. Okay, I'm not going to say much more about that. What's next? Well, Bailey's beads. And in this case, I chose an annular eclipse for it. We never actually saw the annular eclipse, so maybe you want to have me take that off my list of successful eclipses. The beauty of this eclipse, though, with a couple of my friends in the audience here, Jay Anderson and Bob Stevens, is that we intentionally went to see the broken annulus and were, as you can see, quite successful with that. When you do something like that, you get extended periods of Bailey's beads. We were watching this go on for about 5 minutes. And you can also see something not often mentioned is that the actual rim seems to roll around. Notice the position angle of the moon, the center of the moon through the most and to the two cusps of the crescent. You see that if you want to get the maximum view, you want to be toward on the north end of the path, in that zone that actually David Dunham was talking about yesterday, and catch the very mountainous southern limb of the moon. Whereas if you want to do the same thing during a total eclipse, you would instead be at the opposite limb, simply because you've got north on north in that case. Here, of course, we're close to the center line. You certainly get the Bailey's beads as the sun is, in this case, reappearing. The nice thing about it, again, is that you can extend that. The same goes for the diamond ring. The diamond ring appears because of very deep valleys on the moon. And to extend that, if you are off-center in the direction of where you anticipate that diamond ring, you can have a longer duration of eclipse, or rather of the ring itself, at the loss of some corona time. We now get these again in the eclipse bulletins, and you can estimate where diamond rings might, a diamond ring or more diamond might appear by looking at the actual true relief illustrated here. Were I to predict, I might have said for 19, this was 2006, just last year, where there might have been one in this area and possibly over on this side. But again, that's in a sense part of the game of trying to estimate where these might appear. Also, a few people got it.
They have.
This is up in the direction of outside Sacramento Peak Observatory, and I think they probably had to go straight to the legislature to actually get a highway numbered like this, because it bears no relation to the numeration scheme that New Mexico uses. Oh, okay. I have confirmation of that. But 6563, of course, is the hydrogen alpha wavelength in angstroms, and we get to see the chromosphere, and we can look then at the flash spectrum in that. Do you want to see an extended flash spectrum? Again, you want to extend the your duration of seeing the chromosphere, and to do that, you want to be on one of the nearer one of the edges of the shadow path than on the center. This happened to be a center line view from La Paz in 1991, and you can see the transition, including, in this case, you can see the green line along with red line here that we've heard about just this afternoon, and still the prominences, of course, with this eclipse were so extended that they see them in H alpha. Here, actually, this is probably helium with H alpha over here still visible. I know there are a number of Europeans here, and they probably look down on California wines, but I gotta say, you can't beat this label. And with it, I introduce prominences, and remind you that, again, unless you have advance notice of where they're going to be, and that's pretty difficult, except shortly after sunrise on the day of the eclipse, you don't have much choice in trying to plan for them. What I can say is that your choice can depend on what you're trying to do. If you would like to get a stereo pair, and in this case, again, 1991, we kind of lucked out with two very large prominences, one on each limb, you actually can get a stereo pair and combine those. Some of you may even be able to do that here in the audience and see that the moon is, in fact, in front of the sun. Keeping that in mind, though, there is less option you have in trying to extend your chances or the duration of observing prominences, and it's going to be dependent on the sunspot cycle. Since they do tend to be with sunspots, there will be more of them at the height of the sunspot cycle, as you can see here, and with prominences and filaments, depending on where they are in the disk, of course. But notice that they don't generally go all the way up to the poles in any period of time. They do get moderately close, and towards sunspot minimum, you're not going to see very many at all. So only some offset from the center line makes sense in a situation where you're trying to extend the view of prominences, and that's one where I would want to have a lot of mobility, potentially even setting up on the center line in advance, and then based on what I saw with an H-alpha telescope, assuming there was some driving time, actually moving off-center if I wanted to take advantage of that. Having those prominences as we did in 1991 is pure luck of the draw. What about the corona? Well, as we have seen, the corona is magnificent, and there's not much to say about it except that it does change its shape and extent, and actually kind of contrary to what I'm showing here, usually a sunspot maximum corona is going to be brighter with longer streamers in the radial direction, whereas during a sunspot minimum or near minimum corona, it's much more extended, mostly along the ecliptic. And so that can factor into a decision to say, well, maybe I want to concentrate on something else for this eclipse rather than going for the maximum duration of corona viewing. Americans are good for fads, and some of you may remember Pet Rocks. And that was about the same time that the 1979 eclipse came around, and some very clever people decided to can darkness and sell these. I did not pay for this, I want to assure you. But they were giving them away at a conference a few months later, and I said I couldn't resist, so I've kept it all this time and now had an opportunity to share it with you. What happens when it gets dark? No. I don't want to let the dark out. Your placement on that path, now we're not talking about towards or away from the edge, no center line or edge, we're talking about beginning or end, is going to greatly affect what you see in the sky. And this is just an example from 2002. Notice the eclipse sun is here, again charts from Fred's bulletins. In 2002 over Africa, approximately, there were a lot of bright stars and planets that one could see, given the blessing of the cloud gods. On the other hand, if you were in Australia, you really did not have very much that was going to be visible. Here's Canopus, but the whole sky has shifted. So if seeing stars in the sky makes a difference, this is something you want to consider when looking at the whole path. Again, subject to what the cloud gods say. So we can end up with something like in 1998, right? Jupiter, very close to the sun. On the other hand, Jay, this goes back to 1974, and it's a poor scan. I need to do this again of a slide, but it turned out the Southern Cross was right in this area of the only open part of the sky where you could see anything around the clouds. I too got my early experience with a clouded out eclipse on my first one. Seeing the shadow is also one of those things that depends greatly on where you are along the full length of the path of totality. Again, there is some variation, obviously, with where distance from the center line. But if you were watching, this is actually 1988, an all-sky view with a reflective hemisphere, and the shadow approaching the sun, as you can see, is fairly high. It wasn't real high in the sky, but it was pretty high. And here it simply gets darker and darker. I submit to you that this is one of the most spectacular things you can see, and certainly the fact that in Australia in 2002 we were stuck with the choice of there or in the clouds. We're forced into this, but it was a magnificent view. It really seemed like the shadow was a column over us because it was much brighter off to the sides of the path than we're used to. It was a narrow path as well, which made a difference here. Also, you should keep in mind the same effects can occur. You're not going to see very much with the departure of the shadow in a high sun zone, but with the low sun, the possibility is there to see the shadow as it departs Earth's surface. Here you can see that from an eclipse flight in 1981, and you get a little bit of hint, mostly from these scan slides, of just the motion of the shadow. This is probably a little bit late for seeing the shadow depart in 2002. Shadow motion is also quite apparent when you are looking at a low sun eclipse, and here you can see totality, and totality ended with a diamond ring in this wide-angle view. The position, again, in the path does make a great difference now, if we're talking from center line to one of the edges, as to what you see. And I offer up this example. We have here a lot of clouds, and the sun still in partial eclipse. During totality, you'll notice it's quite dark here, the usual typical sunset colors, but this was in the direction of land and the nearest edge of the shadow. The center line, in fact, was in the other direction, out this direction. Notice there aren't, even on the original, you don't see sunset colors here, simply because they're so far away. This was, in fact, a four-minute eclipse, had you been on the center line, which was offshore. Well, there are other things that you can end up seeing. Of course, the sunset colors I've mentioned already. Judy Anderson, I'm not sure if she's still in the audience. Yeah, she's still here. And I had the distinct pleasure and surprise in 2002 at the sunset annular eclipse. 92. Of seeing the upper, and this picture does not show it at all. There, I couldn't find the one I wanted to use. But the upper limb of the sun as it was setting actually turned the full set of colors before it actually went beneath clouds. And we could see everything from at least green through red. And I don't know, Judy, maybe you saw blue with it as well. As the sun was in this very low, almost setting position. I had been expecting perhaps a double, seeing the cusps of the crescent as they went down showing green, but I had not anticipated at all seeing green, yellow, orange, red across the whole thin upper limb as the sun was setting. It was absolutely spectacular. Just a real variation on a green flash. Also, another effect that I hadn't really noticed and didn't see the full extent of in that same eclipse, but David Levy pointed out to me later, was that, first of all, the sunset was very dark. You know, twilight seems to last a long time normally, but this was with the moon's shadow covering most of the sun as after sunset still. The twilight itself was quite dark, and especially compared to the next day. And also, David reported that from where he was, he could actually see twilight brightening as the eclipse was ending below the horizon for him. Yeah. So, which is, and I'm getting affirmation here in the front row. So, it's something, again, to be looking for, and it's not something you can see except, well, with the sunrise, it would be the opposite effect, or the sunset. But you're not going to see it with a high sun eclipse. Shadow bands seem to require having a very narrow crescent, and you can extend the period when you've got a very narrow crescent by being at the edge of or near the edge of the path. You still are not going to lose a lot of totality, but you can have a longer period to hopefully catch these things. I've been to 15 eclipses now and totals, and only seen three. So seen it three times. So maybe other people have had more luck than I have, and I've never gotten a picture of it. So here is my list now of items, and what I would say to you as to where to go if you are intrigued by any of these. Partial phases, well, just pick a long eclipse. You'll have longer partial phases. Bailey's beads, go to the south limit. I may have said this wrong. No, I said it right. South limit for a total eclipse. Be near the north limit for an annular eclipse. Diamond. Sorry?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I did say it. I suddenly wasn't sure I had. Diamond ring, I pick the direction and head towards, not necessarily the edge of the path, but in the direction where I saw the deepest lunar valley. Chromosphere, pick a limit if you want and extend it. As we heard yesterday, getting flash spectra and being able to time the disappearance of the flash spectrum and then the reappearance of the flash spectrum would be very helpful in understanding any changes in the diameter of the sun. Chromosphere, if you're really trying to get chromosphere, I'd pick the limit with the smoothest lunar relief. That's probably going to be on the northern side of the sun, but you have to balance that with anything else you want to see. Prominences, a shorter eclipse actually wins because, in fact, you're going to have extended time in the sense of not having a too large moon covering up the sun. Corona, obviously be on the center line at the maximum eclipse point and enjoy the view. Stars, again, you want a long eclipse. Why? Because the shadow extends further out, you're going to have a darker sky, and you will have more time to look for stars. Shadow approach and recession, you can be almost anywhere, including out of the path of totality, though I don't think I'd recommend that to anybody. And I'd go for a longer eclipse just because the shadow is bigger. If you really want to see that shadow, though, sunrise or sunset is the place to be. landscape. Short eclipse, that 360-degree sunset, works much better with having a small shadow so you can see those sunset colors. Shadow bands, edge of the path, long eclipse works best. And finally, I'll stick my neck out. And if you want to see weather phenomena, what happens with all the cooling, and I'll let Jay jump on me if he wants to, I guess I'd recommend just going to the center line, long eclipse, and have your weather instruments out to see what you can see. So with that, let me remind you what Norm Sperling said, that totality, no matter how long its duration, seems to last only 8 seconds.
Less than 8 seconds.
And finally, I'll close with, wherever you are, please enjoy the show. Thank you. I guess I ran Jay out of the room. I think we have a few minutes for questions. Yes.
Regards to impact on animals, I would recommend going on the center line for the duration of the totality. It has an impact on wildlife and insects.
Yes, I concur with that too. Comment was just that a longer duration of totality will have greater impact on wildlife. A brief story, since we've got...
And being on the center line,
yes. Brief story with that is, on the center line in 1980, we were in Tsavo, just outside Tsavo East National Park, and it was amazing to me just how all of a sudden quiet the whole plains got. You weren't aware of the sound until totality hit, and then it got just amazingly quiet. Just a very great surprise to me. Yes?
What about, elevation 2,000 or 3,000 meters to see the shadow advancing and receding in real time as opposed to 2,000 miles an hour?
The comment is, what about elevation to extend the period of totality, or seeing the shadow? I got it right. Of seeing the shadow. And yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I actually meant to discuss that as well. Getting altitude is very helpful in seeing that. The best pictures I've actually seen of the advance and recession of a fairly high sun shadow come from the observations made at Mauna Kea by a friend of mine who was fortunately looking down at the clouds below him, and he could really see the approach, and he was able to photograph the approach of the shadow. So having that is definitely an advantage. I was considering even going to, I think it was Popocatépetl in Mexico in 1991, for being able to get in the path and still be at about 14,000 feet with a view down. Didn't end up doing that, but the thought was there. The weather wasn't going to be likely to be good for that eclipse. Yes, Daniel?
I just wanted to contradict your statement that looking the shadow seeing, you want to have the sun low. In Libya, for example, last year, we had the sun like 60 degrees high, and the receding shadow, this wall of darkness racing through the desert, was actually one of the most memorable effects of the whole eclipse. So it just depends on that you remember to look for it.
Well, I've remembered to look. I've tried to photograph it, as I've shown you, and I haven't had that experience, but I'm happy to be contradicted. You know, it's we each have our own sensitivities. Yes?
Yeah, comment about shadow bands. I've been to quite a few eclipses. I've only seen them a couple of times also. Have you done any surveys to find out whether they tend to appear more, let's say, on land as opposed to maybe out on a cruise ship or something like that?
I have not done any surveys. The question is about frequency. Did you want to comment?
Well, I've never failed to see the shadow bands on an eclipse. I found that altitude is favorable to seeing them, although not on a plane. It's very hard on being too high of altitude. But I haven't seen a difference between land and sea on shadow.
Okay.
They're high phenomena, so there shouldn't be any difference whether you're on land or sea.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I've heard it's theoretically possible when you see shadow bands at sunrise and sunset, those kind of time, the first tiny bit of the sun. Has anybody ever seen the sunrise and sunset?
I have heard the same thing about seeing shadow bands, just using a distant mountain as your occulter and having a screen to look. I have tried on a couple of occasions and not had success, but I don't consider that to veto it. I haven't seen shadow bands that often either, so I'm not too surprised. Yes?
In New York City, on a clear day, if you stand, or in any large city, stand behind a large building that's as far away as possible.
Right.
If you have a very clear day, you'll see a fluttering in the Terminator zone, the light to dark, which looks very similar. And I've not really ever seen convincing shadow bands, and when I've seen that in a large city, particularly New York, I thought, gee, it really must be something related to the same way.
We had two very pronounced instances of shadow bands. One was in 2003 on the ice in Antarctica, and if anybody was here, they might remember. Before the eclipse, it was the sun was moving in retrograde and the moon was moving across it, and because it was so very low on the horizon, Xavier, you probably remember this, like maybe 10 minutes before the eclipse, we had such a flickering in the environment with the, and it had to do with a lot of contrast on the surface between a very white ice and the texture in the ice. But the shadow bands were also visible. As you look towards the sun, there was a flickering effect upon your eye. And the other time that it was very pronounced on the ship in Galapagos 2005, we did have a very small slit because the sizes were so, it was such a small difference in size. But we had a gigantic, the facade of the ship here was white. You didn't see them on the ground at all, but because the white surface was solid, there was the small contrast showed up on the white surface.
Well, just as a final comment, my own pet theory is that really it's a scintillation phenomenon, and if you look at a distant street light, I have seen shadow bands from a distant street light, single one, just you know, a mile or two away, and it you can see shadow bands from that. So I use that as an analogy. My own other comment I'd make to you is that I think that they may be more easily visible with a not a bright white surface because of the contrast issues, and that a gray surface, and I can't give you a number as to how gray, but a gray surface might be more effective too. But you've had this success,
yeah.
So...
Yeah, we have video from the 2005 shadow bands on that surface. We didn't mean to be, but it happened to be the backdrop, and it showed up in the video, and it just really, it looked like water running down the surface. It was
have you
scary.
Managed to frame grab any of them and actually get individual frames that
I'd,
show
I'd have to
bands?
I'd have to go back and grab them. I haven't done that yet. Though.
I've always used white sheets on the ground for my
job. But the times I've seen it on snow, but I've also seen it on a sandy surface. I got to quit. Jay's throwing me out.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.